WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
You've been writing biographical novels and biographies for many, many years, since what, the mid-1930s?
Well, yes. I wrote the manuscript of Lust for Life, the Vincent van Gogh story, in 1930 and 31. It wasn't published until 1934.
What has attracted you to the form of the biographical novel?
Well, let me make a distinction. The biography has three persons involved. There's the author, the hero or heroine, and the reader. They go down parallel tracks, but those tracks rarely meet or intermesh. In the biographical novel, there's only one person involved because I spend at least 2.5 years of research and 2.5 years of writing so that I can get inside the brain and the heart and the breast and the blood and the bone of my hero or heroine. So I become the person I'm writing about, and the purpose is that by the time you get down to the bottom of page one, you forget your name and that you live in Philadelphia and the year of 1980, and you become Charles Darwin or Vincent van Gogh or Mary Todd Lincoln or Dr. Sigmund Freud. So we're only one person. We're all three one person, and you live that life emotionally so that you never forget it, and it enriches you forever.
I know I've asked some actors if they've ever felt that they've become the character who they're playing in a play, and many of them have said to me, no, I mean, I'm not insane, I'm not losing my mind or the ability to distinguish who's who, I'm just an actor, it's my art and not my personality that on the stage.
That's not always true. You may remember that Henry Fonda played my Clarence Darrow on the stage and on TV about 2 years ago. He came up to our house to have, I think, drinks or dinner with us and ask us about all of the developments and what we thought about Darrow now, and he has become one of our great folk heroes. After about an hour, he got up from the table in the library, turned his back on us, hunched his shoulders, mussed his hair, and turned around in 30 seconds, and there stood Clarence Darrow. Miracle. Absolute miracle.
But now, when you become the person that you're writing about, what do you mean there? To what extent do you try to be? To what extent are you capable, no matter where you live, of really becoming that person or of really understanding their motivations and what went through their mind?
I've spent my whole life doing it. That's my trade, my art, and my craft. First of all, I gather all of the letters. In the case of Charles Darwin, in my new book, The Origin, there must be about 20,000 letters to him and from him. You see, they had no telephone, and they had no Western Union, so they wrote every day. Darwin must have written an average of 7 or 8 letters a day to his family, his fellow scientists, his friends all over the world. You read these letters, and you begin to hear their unconscious mind working. For example, we all talk to ourselves, true? When we're alone, there's an interior monologue. That interior monologue corresponds very closely, not exactly, but closely, to what we write in letters. And so as I read these letters, and as I read the diaries and the journals, and I read other people's letters and books, and one of them will say, I saw Darwin yesterday, and he told me, and then there's a whole page of what Darwin said in his exact dialogue. So slowly, slowly, as the months go by, weeks and months, and then a year or two, I lose the sense that I am Irving Stone, and I become either Clarence Darrow, or I become Vincent van Gogh, or Michelangelo in The Agony and Ecstasy, or Charles Darwin in The Origin. It's a feat, but it's a way of creating an art.
Now, if I was to read all of Darwin's letters and live on the Beagle and go in his home and do some of the things that you did for writing The Origin, I'd probably write a different book than you would.
Yes, of course you would, because your personality and your background and education are different from mine. But if you read all the letters, diaries, and journals, you would write an authentic Charles Darwin. You would have to, because you would have all of the accurate material you needed to do it.
Why did you choose Darwin as the subject of your most recent book?
Well, as you know, I come out of an academic life. I spent 7 years at the university, and I taught for 3 years at the University of California at Berkeley. During those years, I read very widely across the face of literature, and I came to the conclusion that there are four men. I'm sorry that there isn't a woman among them, but it happens that there isn't, who have created our modern world and our modern mind, your mind and my mind and everyone listening now. Not in the order of their importance, because I don't know anyone who could rate them. They are Einstein, who created our whole space age, Karl Marx, who created the communism that occupies all of the USSR and China, not his communism, their own, but occupies almost half of the world. Then there's Sigmund Freud, who discovered and charted the unconscious mind so that we're now able to understand all of our own motivations and act according to our best interests instead of our worst interests. But the most interesting of all for me is Charles Darwin, because he turned the world around. When he came home from the Beagle in 1837, after 5 years of collecting and geologizing and thinking about the origins of these thousands of species and varieties that he had seen, he released us from chains. We were enslaved, actually. John Henslow, who was his mentor at Cambridge University, said, "I would rather die than see any one of the 37 articles of the Church of England changed." Well, Darwin changed practically all of them in our minds. He freed us to think as we want. He never said there isn't a God. He interpreted God as laws, G-O-D-L-A-W. God created universal laws which are still working. There are a few accidents. God didn't create mice to be eaten by cats. God didn't create worms to eat the intestines of certain animals. These are accidents. But by and large, God's universal law is still in existence, and that's what Darwin set out to prove in all of his books, and I think he did prove it.
In many of your biographies, you've taken great men who have made great contributions, Darwin and the theory of the evolution of the species. You've written about Michelangelo. You've written about Vincent van Gogh, about Clarence Darrow. What type of sense do you want to give about the process of discovery that these people have gone through and coming upon their art or their philosophies?
You're asking what is the common thread?
If there is one.
Yes, there is certainly. Over my desk at home, I have a placard in wood, carved in wood, which says, "Man, comma, against obstacles, comma, for man." I pick an individual, many of them unknown. Vincent van Gogh was unknown in this country in 1930-31. It took me 3 years to sell my manuscript. When my book on Clarence Darrow came out, not one newspaper in New York would review it. They said, "He's a clown, he's a hoodlum, he straps his galluses in court. Now he's a great national hero," you know? So the common thread is that these people, men and women alike, sometime in their lives, young, middle-aged, or old, have a dream or a vision of something they want to accomplish, not for themselves, but to make this world a little more intelligible, a little more orderly, and a little more beautiful. They start, they get beaten over the head, they get knocked down, they get kicked, but they always rise, and they continue the struggle, and they continue their creativity, and at the end of their lives, they have contributed a little something of that vision or dream that they had some years before.
Some artists have been very self-destructive and have had really, not all of them, but some of them, some great people have had really messed up personal lives or a little touch of madness. How do you deal with that when you are writing about such a person?
Well, I try to deal with it honestly, including faults. For example, when I finished one of the chapters on Darwin, and Mrs. Stone had edited it, and we were going to about fifth or sixth draft, because we don't go to the printer until we have a seventh totally polished draft. I gave her the chapter and I decided it was finished. And then about a month later, reading a very obscure monograph, I came across a fact that showed that Darwin had been wrong in some one aspect where I had him right in my chapter. And I said to myself, well, I've been at this 3.5 years and I just stumbled across this by accident. No one else is ever going to know, so why should I bother with it? So I stayed awake all night long, and the next morning I took that chapter back and I rewrote the pages and admitted the fault because I had to. If you're not honest, your book is going to be no good. No one will be convinced. No one will sympathize with your hero or heroine.
Who do you think your readers are? I know there are many people. Do you know who your readers are?
Yes, I think we do. We found out with Lust for Life. There are certain areas in American life where the IQ is so low that they don't want to read a book. We have millions of book readers. When they say that television is, you know, destroying books, not true. We're selling more books every year in America and more people are reading them. We have readers all the way from mailmen, truck drivers, housewives, on up to university presidents, scientists, all over the world. In my home in Beverly Hills, in the library, one wall is called the Stone Wall, capital S, capital W. There are 800 volumes there in 80 languages of all of my books. There is every language where they have a printing press. So we assume the students love them. Now we get our mail from grammar school students as well as high school and college, and we have a large portion of the reading public.
Two of your books that I know of, Lust for Life and The Agony and the Ecstasy, have been made into movies. Were you satisfied with the film versions?
Well, an author is rarely satisfied because the studios say, once we bought your book, you have nothing more to tell us or teach us. So they lock you out of the studio while they make the picture. Lust for Life was brilliantly made. The pictures from all over the world were wonderfully done. They failed to introduced in the very beginning and carried on to the end, the brother-love relationship between Vincent and Theo. When I saw the rough cut at MGM, I said, what happened to the brother-love story? You can't go on without that. So Dori Shary, who died just a few weeks ago, then president of MGM, said, you're absolutely right. So he cabled the man, Englishman, who played Theo, brought him over and had somebody in the studio write seven scenes, which they put in like sliced bologna in a sandwich. But it was a good picture. The Agony and the Ecstasy, unfortunately, that's a very big book, and Michelangelo's life is very long. The book, the picture, concentrated only on the painting of the Sistine Vault, which was 4 years of Michelangelo's life. And while I watched it, I kept saying, hey, remember Michelangelo's the greatest marble carver the world's ever had, the Moses, the David, the Pietà, and all that was left out. So, of course, we felt that there could be another two or three movies very easily.
Would you like to see any of your other books made into movies?
Yes, for the good reason that I'm a book maniac. I love books. I write them. I read them. And I love people who read them and write them. We found that when a movie came out and was circulated all over the world, as movies are, many of the countries in which our books had not been translated then translated the books and have been in publication ever since. Yes, I think that the Charles Darwin book, The Origin, won't make a movie because you cannot get that life into 2 hours or even three. A 12-hour series on television will give us the whole book and that whole great love story of Emma Wedgwood Darwin and Charles Darwin and the magnificent discoveries he made and the way he turned the world around.
Irving Stone, we're out of time. I want to thank you very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure, I assure you.